We'll be discussing interferometry, and if you have a two-particle interferometer where you have two sources, then you can get some interesting effects that you don't see with just single-particle interferometry. And I showed you yesterday one example of that. Here's another example from my own work many years ago, which was inspired by the Elitzer-Weidman-Bohm paper, which I talked about on Monday. So imagine you have two interferometers. So here's one. And I'm drawing it this way to suggest space and time. So time kind of running up the page. And this is an interferometer for positrons. Okay. And we arrange it so that you get destructive interference in this output and constructive interference here. So we call this output D plus, this detector D plus, this detector here, C plus. And we'll label the internal paths like we did last time. So U plus, V plus. Okay. So if we click this button here, then this detector always clicks. Now we introduce a second interferometer, which is for electrons. Just trying to draw this. Everything is symmetric. If you ignore the first interferometer I drew, then we have the same situation that the electrons are always detected at C minus. Like this. Okay. So imagine now we press both of these buttons at the same time. Okay, and so we release an electron going in this direction, and a positron going in this direction, and an electron going in this direction. There's some chance that they will both take these paths here, the U paths. And if they do, they'll meet at this point here. And we assume that then they annihilate with probability one. Okay. So this is a Gedanken experiment. It would be difficult to realize this in a laboratory, but this is just a thought experiment. Okay. So now let's think about this interferometer. And imagine that detector D plus clicks. Okay. Well, we could think of this as being like the Elitzer-Weidman-Bohm experiment, and we could think of the electron as being the bomb, okay? That if the electron is in this path, that's like it having a good trigger, then it will prevent the interference, and so it's possible for the detector D plus to click. And so what that means is that if you see D plus fire, and you have a detector here in path U minus, then that detector will fire. Okay. So D plus implies U minus. Is that clear? Simple. So I'm taking the silence to be an indication that it's clear. Okay, and you can do the calculation properly in the way that I showed you on Monday. Here I'm just using words so that I don't have to write down all the the full calculation. Now, consider instead a different experiment where we remove this detector. And now, instead, let's think about this interferometer as being like the Elitzer-Wyman interferometer, and this one and the positron as being like the bomb. Okay, so if we detect the electron here and detect a D minus, then we know that the detector that is here, U plus, must fire. So. It's really just by symmetry. Okay. So now let's consider an experiment where we don't have any internal detectors. We don't have a U plus or a U minus detector in place. If this detector D plus fires, then we know that we no longer have interference over here because we in some sense we know that the electron is in this path. So the so it's collapsed into the or projected into the eigenstate associated with this path. So when it arrives at this beam splitter, it's going to go 50-50 into either D plus or C minus. And so we know and like I said, you can do a proper calculation and you'll get that. You'll get that the probability of D plus and D minus firing is 1/16. Okay. And then finally, let's consider an experiment where we place a detector in each of these paths. Okay, now you can see that if the positron travels along, if the positron is to arrive at this detector, it has to travel along this path. If the electron is to arrive at this detector, it has to travel along this path. But if they take those paths, then they would have to meet at this point and they would annihilate. So it's impossible for both this detector and this detector to click at the same time. Now, if you look at those predictions, they appear to be contradictory in some sense. Because if you consider a case where D plus and D minus are measured, so you have no internal detectors, so go back to this situation. If you consider this case, and you consider a case where D plus and D minus actually do fire, then you can say, well, since D plus fired, had I placed a detector in path U minus, then that detector should have fired. And since D minus fired, had I placed a detector in U plus, that detector should have fired. And yet we know it's not possible for both detectors to fire at the same time. Okay. So this is an apparent contradiction. Any feelings what the resolution to this is, or the interpretation of this? We can make the, if you actually think in terms of particles, you can make this contradiction seem even sharper. So if D plus fires, then it would seem that the electron must be traveling along this path, because that's how the electron can end up being detected in this path. And if detector D minus fires, it would seem that the positron must be traveling along this path. Because that's how it's possible for the detector in this path. So that's how, that would be how it's possible for the detector in this path to fire. And yet we know that it's impossible for these two particles to pass through point P. So you really have to be careful with sort of classical reasoning in quantum theory. I mean, at a logical level, the resolution to this paradox is that the context in which you do this experiment forbids actually putting a detector here. Okay. And so you can say that I have this prediction in a certain experimental context. So that's a different experimental context than the one where this prediction holds. And likewise for this one. So the inference that this detector U minus would have fired doesn't follow logically. I mean, it's rather strange. If you know with certainty that had I put a detector here, it would have fired. Nevertheless, you have to be mistrustful of that sort of logical, of the logical implication that that's implicit in all of this. Okay. And what's really going on here is there is an assumption, an implicit assumption of locality. So what we have really here is a version of Bell's theorem. Have you covered Bell's theorem in any course so far? I think that hasn't been done. Okay. So later on I will go through Bell's theorem, which is proof that quantum theory has a kind of non-locality built into it. Okay. Any more questions on that? Yeah, go ahead.
Quantum theory has a different foundational set of rules for probability, so why would you expect the logic to be the same? Because logic seems like a partial part of probability.
I think one could say that, but at the same time, I don't think we want to throw out all of logic just because we have a new theory. I mean, we have to be very careful reasoning between different contexts, I think, is what's been shown here in quantum theory, whereas in classical physics, we don't have that problem. But you don't. Some logic still applies in quantum theory. It seems, just not all of it. Go ahead.
Can you explain again why D plus and D minus can fire together sometimes? I missed it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, one way to do that is to do the calculation and to choose a certain sort of foliation of your space time. Okay. So let's foliate space time like this. So on. So I'm going to do the calculation. At a certain point, I'll get this detector D plus fire. And if you remember from the calculation I did before, if D plus fires, then we know that the bomb has a trigger. Well, that's analogous. That means that we end up having we have a sort of D plus U plus term, but we don't have a D plus, sorry, U minus. We don't have a D plus V minus term. So we don't have that if you do the calculation. So now we can take this and evolve it through this beam splitter here. When we do that, we'll get some probability of it going into the D minus and some probability of it going into the C minus detector. Okay. So that's a sort of simplification. That's the essential point in the calculation. You have to start from the very beginning and go through these beam splitters and go for this beam splitter. You get the same thing if you do it in a different hypersurface, but that just shows you the point. Okay. No more questions. Good. So I want to talk about the measurement problem in quantum theory. Sometimes if you look at lists of the most serious, you know, the most important problems in physics, the measurement problem will appear on those lists. Sometimes it doesn't. It depends on who compiles the list. I think it's an important problem in physics. However, it should perhaps also come with a public health warning, because people who think too deeply about the measurement problem can go crazy. You don't really have to think about it if you want to make progress, even in quantum foundations, but it's always a problem that's out there, and I think ultimately we need to understand what's going on there. So before coming to the measurement problem, I'm going to write down some axioms for quantum theory. So these will just be, you know, similar to standard axioms you'll find in a textbook. And it's going to be for finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and for pure states. Which keeps things simple. You can also write down axioms for quantum theory in terms of, for example, mixed states. And I think that those are actually more interesting than the ones I'm going to write down. But we need to start somewhere. So let's start here. So there'll be five axioms. Every good set of axioms, there should always be five axioms in a good set of axioms, I think. So the first axiom is that associated with each system is a Hilbert space. And I'm using the notation that A is the system type, and 1, or this integer that appears here, is the instance of that system. So you might have, you know, several instances of a given system type, like photons or electrons, whatever, and then you can label them by different integers. The Hilbert space has a certain dimension, and we're taking it to be finite. The first axiom. Axiom 2 concerns composite systems. So an example of a composite system would be A1, A2, B3, C4. The Hilbert space is the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for each of the components. So in the example here, the Hilbert space would be just tensor product. And I should say that we're not going to worry about identical particles for the purposes of these axioms. Those are interesting, but we can introduce the measurement problem, and lots of the conceptual issues are interested in this simple framework. So next axiom is that the state of the system is an element of the associated Hilbert space. So state of a system at any given time. Two more axioms. Evolution. The next one concerns evolution. So there's two cases. First case concerns when there is no measurement, the second case when there is measurement. So if there's no measurement, the state evolves unitarily. So U is a unitary operator. And this is really the integral form of the Schrodinger equation, where then U is given by a Hamiltonian. And the second case is where you have a measurement. Then the state is projected with the projector that's associated with the measurement outcome that you see. So the state goes like that, where P is a projector. So that's four. There's one more axiom, which has to do with probabilities. And I think the fifth axiom is kind of, in some sense, the weird one, although 4b is already kind of weird. But it really is axiom 5 that makes 4b weird. And it concerns probability. So the axiom is that the probability of a given measurement outcome is given by the square modulus of the amplitude in front of the state after projection. So the probability is equal to the square amplitude, so that's equal to this, so I'm just taking, this is the state, if I take the state and hit it with itself, that gives me the square amplitude of, the square modulus of the amplitude in front of that. And projection operators are defined having the, to have the property that p squared equals p. So that's equal to that. And this is sometimes called the Born rule. Okay. So I think what's strange about this axiom is that it introduces probability into the picture. Previously we didn't have probability, and now we do. And you know, probabilities are conceptually a difficult beast to understand. I would say that the problem of understanding probability is more serious than the problem of understanding quantum theory, except for the fact that quantum theory does contain probabilities. If you look in the philosophical literature, there's all sorts of attempts to understand what probabilities are. You know, there's thinking of probabilities as propensities or pre-existing things, thinking of them as frequencies, something that you get after a sort of long-run trial, thinking of them in a sort of Bayesian way where they correspond to beliefs. I think it's a very problematic notion, and quantum theory makes probabilities an unavoidable part of physics. Okay, before I move on, any questions on these axioms? I think there... Are you raising your hands or just? Yep.
In part three, we didn't say anything about the state vector being normalized, but it seems like in part five we're assuming it's normalized.
No, actually we're not, because if it was normalized, this would be equal to one. And I understand your question, your point, right? Okay, good. I understand. So in part three was this one. Yeah. Okay, good point. Yeah, there's a subtle thing here. I think if you begin a calculation and you make various measurements, at the beginning of that calculation, you should, in fact, normalize your state. And so you're quite right there. But then after you make one measurement, and then you make another measurement and another measurement, the state stops being normalized because it's projected and has this amplitude in front of it. And then what you're calculating are joint probabilities for those measurement outcomes. At any point, if you want, you can normalize your state. And then you kind of lost all that information about the earlier probabilities. And you're once again, so you're now conditioning on all those early measurements. And now you start again. And then if you don't normalize it and you make various measurements, you're again calculating the joint probability.
It just seems strange that in part three we don't require it to be normal.
Yeah.
We just say it's an element of the space.
I mean, I think I could add it there, except...
when we say it's an element of the space, do we mean it's an arbitrary element, or do we mean it's some specific element?
No, you have a good question. I'm just thinking of the best way to address that. I think if we say here, this is the probability. Conditioned on our earlier preparation. For this given measurement conditioned on an earlier preparation, then we should definitely normalize it. If, however, this is the joint probability of this measurement outcome and earlier measurement outcomes, then we should be careful. Just because I think you have a good point, I'm gonna conditioned on. Earlier preparation. Okay. There is a tendency in quantum theory to just normalize a state every time you have it, and then you end up throwing away information, which is useful because it's there, it's built into the amplitude in front. I think one should think carefully about that when you're doing calculations. And one of the disadvantages, so often what you do is you normalize the state. You say the new state is is that, and then you've thrown away the information, but you've also it's nonlinear. And so you've introduced this nonlinear, and it depends if you want to do. You need to do this if you're calculating conditional probabilities. Conditional probabilities are kind of nonlinear beasts. Whereas if you don't normalize at this stage, everything is still a joint probability. However, you're quite right that at the beginning you do need something that you're conditioning on. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Why we needed to separate infinite dimensional and finite dimensional hyperspaces?
So I think the axioms I have here would apply to that case too, but then I think you have to be technically more careful about some of the objects you introduce. The projectors, I think, would become more tricky in unitary objects. So because I want to get at the conceptual questions, I'm sticking with finite dimensional quantum theory. Which is not to say there aren't interesting conceptual questions that arise in the context of infinite dimensional quantum theory, but those are often of a more technical nature, and they obscure what I think are quite simple issues. Yeah, go ahead.
It's always a kind of confusion that we never really define what is measurement. We just...
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah, there's no measurement, and it is a measurement.
I'm coming to the measurement problem, so I was going to talk about this, of course. The question is what actually constitutes a measurement apparatus, and is it something that has to be big? Is it something that has to have, is a fly sufficient, or you know, like an ant or a fly, or does it have to be, you know, a mammal or a human? Or John Bell joked, you know, does it have to be someone with a PhD? Which I guess excludes most of you people here. But so there is this question: at what point do you accept that measurement happens? Yeah, and that's a big part of the measurement problem. Okay. I should say here in this in part B here, I used the word project, and there's another word that's used in this kind of context, which is collapsed. I deliberately used the word projected because it implies a mathematical procedure, whereas collapse implies something physical. And we can later talk about, you know, actual physical collapses and how they fit into the measurement problem. Okay. So let me move on to the measurement problem now. So I'll go back to that example I had in Monday's lecture, just a very simple example. You have a source, it emits a particle, and the particle hits a beam splitter, and then you have detectors. And so the evolution here is initially you have the particle from the source and that evolves then to a superposition after it goes through the beam splitter. And then next, the particle is either detected at A or B. So you go to a superposition. So the first term has the detector A firing, and the second term has detector B firing. And then, according to 4B, you have a measurement, so detector A clicks, and then you go to of course, it could have been detector B that clicked instead. We go to this, and then according to postulate 5, the probability is 1 over 2, which is the square modulus of 1 over root 2. Okay. So, the measurement problem, it's really a dilemma. You have two horns of a dilemma, and whichever way you go, you have problems. So, on the first horn, you have has been called the reality problem. So I'm going to assume now there's no actual collapse. So for this first horn of the dilemma, I'll assume there's no actual collapse. In the second horn, I'll assume there is actual collapse. And so now the state is really, to use the hockey stick, the state is really this, because there's no actual collapse. This projection is just a mathematical artifact. So what we really have is this. And now we have a kind of discrepancy. We have a discrepancy between what we actually see, which is detector A firing, and what the state is according to quantum theory, which has both A and B firing. So there's a kind of discrepancy between what we imagine reality is like and what quantum theory says it's like. We see a different outcome. Okay. So, so there's various attempts to resolve the reality problem in literature. And so one of those approaches is to say, no, actually, the quantum state that you have here, that superposition, is what reality is like. And that's all of reality, that's everything. And this is the many worlds approach. So let me just bring this down again. So what you would do there typically is you would include yourself, or I'll include me, in the wave function. And then after the detector clicks, and then I see the detector clicking, then we have a cat that says I see detector A click. Over here, and then another one in this case where it says I see detector B click. And then we have this projection, we don't have collapse, I think we just have this term. And the many world approach tries to make sense of this, to say that even though the world, even though this is the description of the world, it's consistent with us having definite experiences, because in each of these terms, we have definite experiences. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the many worlds approach in more detail in a later lecture. But you see here the reason for that approach. So yeah, so one type of solution is many worlds. Another approach is to say, well, yeah, the wave function is what we have there in the second line, but it's not the full story. We have to add some additional hidden variables. And those hidden variables tell us what we actually see. Okay, so they pick out one of those, in this case, one of those two experiences for us. The most famous example of a hidden variable model is the de Broglie-Bohm model. I'll talk about that also in a subsequent lecture. Okay. Any no questions on this?
Yeah. With the many wealth example, why is classical theory not equally problematic? If you toss a coin in the air, it's got one of two solutions, but when it lands, it always has one.
Right. I think in the classical theory, there's a less problematic sort of deeper description where you have an actual trajectory, which we just follow one of those two paths. Although you may use some kind of probabilistic framework, people in classical physics, people usually believe that there is some deeper theory, which would be where all the particles take some definite trajectories, But that kind of approach is more problematic in the case of quantum theory. Although the de Broglie-Bohm model does try to do it. One of the big problems which I'll talk about in Many Worlds is making sense of the notion of probabilities. It turns out to be quite problematic. And those problems in some sense also exist in the case of classical systems. But we'll come to that perhaps. Okay. So that's the one horn of the dilemma. The other horn is where you say, no, let's actually have collapse. Two. So now we actually have, imagine that we have some physical collapse. This is problematic for lots of reasons. So the first is the issue that was raised earlier. What actually constitutes measurement? There are various explicit class models, and what they do is they modify the Schrödinger evolution so that systems will end up collapsing one way or another. And we'll talk about the most studied of those is the GRW model. We'll talk about that later. There are kind of two issues that rise here. One is a kind of easy problem. These two issues apply to both the first version where you have no actual collapse and the second one where you do have collapse, but they have a different flavor in each of those cases. So let me call them issue one, as in I. There's a kind of an easy problem, which is what is the basis in which we have our definite outcomes. Okay. So what basis in the Hilbert space is our sensation of definite outcomes with respect to? So up there, I had a basis. I had the basis I see A click and then I see B click. But why not this basis instead? So there's a different basis. I've taken the sum and the difference of those two states, and those are two orthogonal state vectors. And it could be that that's the basis with respect to which I have my sensations are with respect to. Now that's kind of strange, you know, because I can't quite imagine what it feels like to have the sensation I see A click plus I see B click, and how that would differ from I see A click minus I see B click. But we need a reason to say why it's the basis I chose over there rather than this basis. Physics should provide that reason. Okay. I call this the easy problem because there's a sort of generally accepted approach to this, which is to use decoherence theory. So decoherence theory is where you take into account how this whole system interacts with the environment. Now, I didn't put the environment up there, but you could imagine that in addition to S and A0 and B0 and me, I also had another ket corresponding to the environment. And then that would interact, and then you'd have different environmental states according to which outcome you saw. And then you can use decoherence theory, and that will generally support using the basis that I have here, I see A click and I see B click, rather than a basis like this. Because the density matrix for the system of interest will be diagonal in that basis, rather than a basis like this. Okay. So so that's some theory which I won't go into now, but it's but most people think that decoherence theory solves this easy problem. It's worth saying, in collapse models like the GRW model, you have explicit collapse, which then kind of provides a solution to that problem anyway, because the dynamics actually force one or the other. And that relates really to the second problem, which is I'm calling it the hard problem. You have the easy and the hard problems of consciousness, and so I borrowed that terminology here. And the question here is, what actually picks out one of the two possible outcomes? So it's one thing to say, you know, to give a mathematical prescription for what the basis is, but it's a different thing to say what actually picks out that we have one experience rather than the other. And each of the different interpretations attempt to solve this kind of problem in a different way. So for example, the De Broglie-Bohm model actually has some additional hidden variables, and those are the ones that pick out the definite outcome. The collapse models, you have a collapse, like I said, that picks out one outcome or another. In the Manuel's interpretation, I think it's more interesting, and I think I'll come to that when I discuss it. I think it's a very subtle thing there. Okay, so I've almost finished. Let me just say, you don't have to waste your life thinking about the many worlds, especially not the many worlds. You don't have to waste your life thinking about the measurement problem. And the reason for that is that you can do quantum theory perfectly well without solving that problem. What's the reason for that? Well, let me introduce, this was an acronym from John Bell. Really demolishing the chalk today. FAP. FAP stands for all practical purposes. And John Bell introduced this term as a kind of as a sarcastic way of talking about the attitude that most people have towards physics, because as long as you introduce the point at which you introduce measurement is sufficiently macroscopic, then for all practical purposes, it's very difficult to ever re-interfere those two outcomes. So for all practical purposes, it doesn't actually make any difference. You know, there's not really any hope of re-interfering a detector having clicked A or a detector having clicked B, and even less hope of re-interfering the brain state corresponding to IC detector A click and the brain state corresponding to IC detector B click. And it's only if you can re-interfere those states that you can really see a difference between, you know, actually collapsing the wave function or not collapsing the wave function. So this is the reason that you don't need to solve the measurement problem to do physics perfectly well. Okay, are there any questions on that? Good. And I'll stop.